before I hand over to Ms. Bobaes, I have some information to present in an electronic manner, if that is okay with the panel. The first and second documents are the housing development capacity assessment reports that were requested by Commissioner Dawson. The first is the housing development, the second is the business development. They are around 350 and over 200 pages. What I propose to do is send a link of the documents to the secretariat, and perhaps we could give them an exhibit number.
Yes, that would make sense.
Yes, so I think this is the first for the hearing, so 15.1 for the housing development capacity assessment report, and 15.2 for the business development capacity assessment report. These were both adopted by the Planning and Strategy Committee on 10th of May of this year. And on to a slightly different matter, the Environment Court has issued two consent orders this morning on the proposed Otago Regional Policy Statement. And in the same way, I don't have hard copies, but I will forward an electronic copy to the Secretariat, and I suggest that they also be given exhibit numbers. The first is on rural activities, so that would be exhibit 15.3. And the second is of little or no relevance to this hearing, I think, but it is the Waitaki Trust Board, so it seeks some refinement to the section on kaitahu in the introductory sections of the RPS, but I'm handing that up just for completeness. So that would be exhibit 15.4. And that is all from me, thank you.
In my view, it exists so that residential flats are primarily used for occupation by the residents rather than used primarily for business accommodation.
But presumably, they could be used for RBA, so according to what you've drafted, they could be used for 42 days a year.
Correct.
So they're not going to be any good for long-term rental if they use 42 settlements a year, are they?
No, that's correct. So so with the more limiting framework for RBA, if you were to use a residential flat to provide accommodation and there wasn't a usual occupant, then it would come within the category of an RBA.
No, no doubt. Say the residential flat is no more than 60 square metres than the lower density suburban zone.
Yes.
Now, why would it not be a home occupation for the occupants of the unit to let that flat out?
I agree with you that it's not the PDP definition of home occupation does exclude homestays, and then there's a rule framework within, we'll use the example of the low density suburban residential zone. So within that, home occupations are a permitted activity, and then at rule 7.5.17, that sets out the standards for home occupations.
Sorry?
So at rule 7.5.17, this is by way of example in terms of
yes.
home occupations and the lower density suburban residential zone.
Yes.
So I agree that there are some similarities. In terms of the rule framework that we have for home occupations in this instance, the number of heavy vehicles are restricted.
Well, it can't be a homestay because home occupation excludes homestay.
Correct. So what I'm trying to point out is the distinguishing between the two activities.
Mm.
In my view, having separate definitions for home occupation, for homestays, for residential VA does help with us being able to categorise them and to give certainty on the rule framework for these individual activities. So I think it.
Shouldn't all activities that have the same level of generated effects as permitted activities be given the same status? I'm trying to understand what the difference of generated effects would be between someone renting out their residential flat as a not an RBA, because it wouldn't come under those rules, but on a regular basis for 365 days of the year, short-term stays, with no heavy vehicle movements, no more than one person from off-site working in the business. In fact, most of the people I would presume have none, but we don't have a case of a cleaner. What distinguishes the effects of that activity from, for instance, someone who is a sign writer and does sign writing on vehicles in their property as a home occupation, complying equally with the standards for home occupation. And I make these comments having one of each on either side of me. Not in the lowest density suburban zone, but complying with all the provisions.
No, I do agree that there are strong similarities between with the use of a dwelling or a residential flat for home occupation or homestay. I would say that the rules don't limit it, but I would say that generally home occupations don't involve people coming from outside of the community group and staying overnight on a regular basis.
But that could be your home occupation. That could be your business.
Yes, yes.
I mean,
the rules don't limit
it. If you're retired,
yes,
that can be a business. To supplement the meagre allowance that we supply.
I guess I've looked at it in terms of the rule framework that we have in the PDP for home occupations and whether or not homestay could fit within the framework that terms of, so in using this example, so rule 7.5.17.3 limits the maximum net floor area to 60 square metres to be occupied by the homestay.
And many residential flats wouldn't exceed 60
metres. Yes, correct. In terms of enforcement,
well, I'm not worried about enforcement, I'm worried about the effects. What are the effects that are different? And you haven't told me any yet.
No, okay. no, I agree that they could be treated as similar activities.
Okay.
I think the effects, we've probably got more certainty around the effects of homestays. We know that you don't usually occupy the site. To the site,
that's
any time
in
for a period of time.
But isn't it likely that if people running the home for the visitor accommodation activity and the residential flat are living in the unit, the adverse effects created by visitors are likely to be very slight because they'll be supervised?
They'll be well managed. Yes, I would agree with that assumption.
And in terms of residential cohesion, that's unaltered.
No, I think you make a really good point.
Can I ask what? I mean, given that there's the similarity that you agreed between the two, what are the real differences in the rule between the rules? In other words, in terms of what consents would be required or what limitations? They both permit it to a certain extent. They don't result in greatly different outcomes. But one's a discretionary activity
to extend
the standards, and one's not applied.
No, I accept that, that there is a different threshold.
Why is
there
a different threshold?
In terms of achieving the key purpose of the low density residential design, which is
but in the scenario I put to you, what is it you're trying to achieve that is otherwise contrary to the provisions in the plan? If you use the residential flat for home occupation, which is equally permitted, because the residential flat is deemed to be part of the residential unit, so that equally could be used as a home office. I know there was, I'm not sure if it still exists, but there was a dentist operating on that basis in Wellington for a while. I know there's some physiotherapists. So those aren't unusual situations. Mm-hmm. Now, what distinguishes that use of the residential flat from visitors staying overnight?
Yeah, no, I accept that the home occupation rule would mean that, so 60 square metres of the floor area of the site where there's a residential unit could be for home occupation. I'm happy to reflect on it and have another look at it. And I can look at it in the context of the way that home occupations are treated within each of the zones. Subject to the plan change?
Well, is part of the answer that maybe residential visitor accommodation should exclude those circumstances where it's a home occupation?
I'd like to reflect on that. If I could come back to you on that in my reply, I'll certainly make a note.
Yes, well, there's a number of things that various witnesses have said they'll come back to us on these. And I think in the context of these hearings, we need to have what they're coming back to us with before the reply, so that the submitters that we are to hear, probably mainly the week after next, and subsequently have the chance to comment on those matters. I mean, if we're making, if the Ms. Bovis, for instance, makes significant changes as a result of our questioning to the residential visitor accommodation provisions, I think it's only fair that those people such as Airbnb and Property Act have an opportunity to comment on those. If it comes in and apply, it's essentially new information.
So I'm not sure it's any different to any of the other hearings we've had.
I know, we've been very liberal with you on the other hearings.
Yes, I mean, we're happy to do that. Perhaps I could file a very brief memorandum with the questions, essentially.
Mm. Yes, that did occur to us when we went through some of the rebuttal material on speed 14, and some of it was potentially new, but we felt that the environment court will deal with that in due course.
Yes, so I understand you are sitting for 2.5 days next week.
Yes, and the hearings in Monaco, I don't think this information would, it may be of importance to those submissions, but I don't think it's fundamental to those submissions.
Okay.
Whereas those that are in the week following that, I think that is really more important.
Okay, and can we define this request just around visitor accommodation, or is it a more general request?
I'd say it's around visitor accommodation, yes. So that's the matter that Mr. Hayes was going to get back to us on, and Ms. Bovis.
Yes. Okay.
And Ms. Bovis, if we turn now, and I'm using the low agency residential zone as an example here, because I think the objectives and policies are pretty similar to what is proposed. And I can't recall, were you the original author of this? Or?
No.
No. It's been blended into your lap, so.
I'm section 42A on
that. Yes, that's okay. So you may have to take my comment personally.
That's right.
Looking at the proposed objective 7.2.8, what is the environmental outcome that that objective is trying to achieve?
It's seeking to manage the location, scale, and intensity of the visitor accommodation activities to maintain residential character.
Is management an environmental outcome?
No, not in itself.
No. So
it's a method to achieve an environmental outcome.
So what the outcome is to maintain the residential character. Is that?
That's my reading of it, yes.
Yes. And then in the 7.2.9, we have the same issue. What is the outcome that objective is aiming for?
So, through the management of those activities, ensuring that residential units and residential flats are predominantly used for residential activities, and the character of the zone is maintained.
Well, we've already got the character of the zone being maintained, haven't we? So, say they're not repetitive as well. Errors tend to get repeated. And now, referring to the standards, I just want to explore with you this issue that residential visitor accommodation and homestays, if the standards are breached, non-compliant. Why non-compliant? I mean, that this, in a new district plan, non-compliant is essentially saying not allowed. So more than 42 days for residential visitor accommodation is impossible, and having four people in a homestay is impossible. Why that strict?
I agree that it is a very high test. And this more restrictive, so the non-compliant activity status has been used within the residential zones that are the key providers of residential activities. And then the less restrictive activity statuses are applied outside of these four zones.
Go back to the subjective that you're just speaking about, which is, and I think I asked you about the overall objective to ensure these zones are predominantly used for residential activities, and that the residential units and residential flats are predominantly used for residential activities.
Correct.
So it's drawing a intended to draw a firm line.
Correct.
In the sand, sort of thing.
That's right.
But you've just had this discussion about homestays, which essentially remain a residential use. Is there a difference between homestays and RVAs in terms of the strength of that status?
I agree that homestays do result in the use of the residential unit for residential activities. So I agree that it is a very high test. I can have another look at that activity status if you'd like.
The chair said, just have four homestay guests to be non-compliant seems very strict.
Yes, I mean, just take my houses. Now, our son's at home, we've got two rooms that we give out to four people, two couples, but that would be non-compliant. But no real effects. The same, if you look at residential visitor activity, you suggested 42 days. Now, what if someone wants to do 45? What is the additional effect of 3 days? I can understand there's a point at which the council needs to have a consent. I had to deal with, a few years ago, a residential visitor accommodation property in Arthur's Point, which had extremely adverse effects on the neighbours. But with conditions, those could be dealt with. Now, essentially, with the non-compliant, you're saying even with conditions, not really a starter. And I'm just wondering whether there's the policies actually justify that.
Okay, I would like to reflect on that, if I may, and I'll come back to you on that.
Now, someone, I can't remember which submitter, but one or more submitters have suggested that there be a provision that if the standards aren't met, it becomes visible accommodation. Why would that not be an appropriate approach?
In my view, the use of definitions to separate these activities is an appropriate method, because I think that it's important that we don't blur the lines between the activities. If you look at the, for instance, in Rule 7.4.17, that outlines the matters of discretion for visitor accommodation activities and the low density visitor accommodation subzone. The scale effect from visitor accommodation, I think, is on a different scale to the effects that would normally be generated by residential VA, because residential VA is limited by the size of the dwelling.
What's the like in this zone that we're looking at, the low density zone, what would be the status for visitor accommodation outside of the subzones?
Yep.
Is it non-compliant?
Non-compliant.
Because it's not listed or something?
Yes.
Non-compliant and as pursuant to Rule 7.4.18.
Oh.
In the subzones, it's non-compliant, it's someone's discretion. Now the other nitpicky thing I have to ask you about. You've recommended restrictions on residential visitor accommodation in Millbrook.
Yes.
Now, Millbrook has been treated as a resort, and there is a definition of resort in the district plan which is focused on visitor accommodation. There have been suggestions in Stream 14 that because there are restrictions on visitor accommodations in Millbrook, it's not a resort and it should be treated as an urban area, and partly as a justification to extend the urban area to include land of the submitter that we're hearing from. Now, I'm wondering whether in drafting these rules, whether the drafters have actually thought about Millbrook's role as a visitor destination and its supply of visitor accommodation as a resort within the district, as opposed to a suburb, which I think the rules are treating it as.
I think in the drafting of the
rules,
I'll just turn to the chapter. To the residential
pressure hanging up in your proposal?
Yes, yes, so I've sought to relate to the questions.
Or it's restricted discretionary duty to not meet the standards.
Correct, so it's permitted application for 42 nights.
The real question is, given that it's a resort, is there even any need for that limitation at all?
I think it's following on from the discretionary activity status of VA and the decision submission for the residential activity area.
But isn't VA different? Isn't that hotel?
Yes, it is different.
Mm. And you might not want to have hotels and motels in the residential portion.
So I think that was the basis for the notified framework, was using that sort of context that's provided in terms of discretionary activity for VA, the residential activity area. And I think that's what's flowed through to the provisions.
The other difference with Millbrook is, as I understand it, that's the opposite to Jack's point. Their restrictive covenants actually provide for the management of each of the residences as RVA by Millbrook.
Within Millbrook.
Yes. And which leads me to wonder whether in fact any restriction on the number of nights is necessary.
And is that management provided through, is that management, so that management isn't provided through the district plan for anything, though?
No.
That's through private departments?
Yes.
There are no new objectives and policies relating to RVA and homestay added into the Millbrook zone through this variation, as I said. And so there's only one objective for that zone.
Which was
optative. Yes, in the optative, which is that visitor, residential and recreational activities are developed in an integrated manner. So given the different objective for this zone, and its recognition as a resort, as the chair said, the question really is, to what extent do there need to be any controls or such strict controls over homestay and RVA? I mean, to have homestay for six guests not compliant seems harsh again, but that comes back to the same discussion we had before. But it certainly is a different zone in terms of its objective and policy structure.
In terms of its purpose, yeah. Okay, I'll take that feedback on board and I'll have another look at those provisions. Thank you.
And in terms of that, there's a number of places in your section 42 where you talked about making Jack's point in Millbrook somewhere.
No, they're not the same.
Yes.
I did bundle them together in terms of the structure of my report.
Yes, and I just wanted to make clear that Jack's points are separate from Millbrook's resorts.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, that was by virtue of the structure of my report. Yes. But no, I do appreciate that. They are very different. They have very different purposes.
I
having sat through all the hearings on these matters, there was certainly from the farming community, both in Stream 2 and in Stream 13, a raising the point that there is a need to diversify from pure farming, and that having people visiting on farms is one of the ways of doing that. And that is reflected in the objectives and policies. For instance, the objective, the range of land uses, including farming and established activities, are enabled while protecting, maintaining and enhancing the landscape. It's not restricting it to farming itself. And the reasons you've given us so far for restrictions on residential visitor accommodation, particularly, have been to do with residential character, which is not relevant in a rural area, and housing supply. And I wouldn't have thought housing supply is an issue in the rural area either. So why, and it may be in relation to the relationship between it, having someone living on the farm and having someone else visiting, and having no one living on the farm but just visitors, but it seems to me that the rules as proposed putting unnecessary limitations on those on farms who wish to diversify their income sources, when one of the particular features that New Zealand can offer to overseas tourists is farm stays. And given that most of our farms are in outstanding natural landscapes, they're exceptionally pleasant farm stays.
Okay, so in the context of the homestay provisions, are you asking me to have a second look at it in terms of residential VA and homestay?
Well, I think it needs to be looked at in both, because many farms have more than one dwelling on them. Because they've had farm workers, or they've had children who lived on the farm and they've moved out. So they end up with empty dwellings that can be used. I don't think it's just a matter of applying the residential provisions in the same way, and in the same vein, and treating residential flats, for instance, because they, in a farm, you may not be dealing with a residential flat equivalent. You might have two or three buildings on it. I mean, you'll be familiar with Devon Dairies.
Yes, very
and
nice.
How many dwellings do they have on that? 6 or 7. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can take a second to look at that framework that we've got for the rules.
And I think the same argument in terms of residential cohesion and housing supply can be applied to both the rural lifestyle and the rural residential. They may need a different treatment from rural, but I don't think they need the same treatment as residential. On the reasons that you're given don't really apply.
I agree that they would need to be treated differently to rural, particularly in terms of their rural residential zone with the density of 4,000 square metres per site.
I mean, I know that Kim is right. people enabled to be in a homestay in the Banks Peninsula, which has, you know, got many characteristics that are similar to Queenstown's rural area in a way. Some outstanding landscapes, difficulty in maintaining sustainable farms, close to a big centre of population, tourist area. And it doesn't really matter, and it doesn't matter how many buildings there are. You know, they could be two people in five dwellings, as long as there's someone living on the farm. So, I mean, it's just a more flexible approach for a rural area. I'm not saying that it should be exactly the same, but it's certainly an approach that's been accepted in other areas, whereas in the residential is quite different again.
So just touching on what Commissioner Nesbitt was saying before, it did seem to me that, I mean, there may be some evidence that one of the main things being with the plan changes, the effect on rental housing stock, there may be a proportion of the district population depends on rental housing stock in a rural area, but it seems to be fairly hard to sort of envisage that that would be a significant factor at all.
No, I agree.
And I should add that in reviewing those, you need to also look at what the base and amenity zone, and I would treat that the same. I have the same view on that as rural, and the precinct, I think, would have to be treated the same as rural lifestyle, given the density proposals as an overlay.
My apologies, I only noticed last night that I didn't
No.
Provisions to the
rebuttal. That occurred to me. I was looking for them, and I was thinking, oh, but they're in.
That's right.
They're in the chapter we dealt with in Stream 14, yes. We were told we were dealing with them in this chapter.
That's right. Yes. Just the.
We haven't got
them. I think Ms. Barbos is going to provide them for us next week.
I'm going to provide them. But they do have a similar framework to what we've proposed here in terms of. Yeah, I do talk about them in my section 42A report. Just the provisions weren't appended. So in my section 42A, I recommend that the same recommended framework applied to the Okatipi Basin provisions. But I've failed to put them. I will give them to you, please. Yes, I would agree that in terms of the precinct, that in terms they would have strong similarities.
Refer you to, I think it's the section 32 report, page 31.
Section
32,
on my section
32. That's attached to your section 42A, page 8 of my electronic file.
At page 31?
Is it paragraph 18, 6.12?
Yes.
Yep. Now, what you see is that a high proportion, that many listings that might be used for visitor accommodation, well, you can see that, like I said, in the section 32 before, if not used for visitor accommodation, are likely to be otherwise suitable as residential properties. And I'm.
It's been talking.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how suitable they would be if they had Well, it may be that the statement is referring to whole houses, but it's, if it is, it, it's unclear.
So it says the high proportion of whole houses slash apartments illustrate that many listings, if not used for VA, are likely to be otherwise suitable as residential properties.
So that is only referring to the whole houses.
Yes, in my, that would be my reading of it.
And then over on page 37, the Thorndyke Cooper report is referred to.
I would say yes in the first bullet. Loss of neighbourhood of neighbours residential field.
Well, that, but that first bullet point is where there's a consistent, a constant expansion of visitor accommodation developments. I read that as being as increased numbers of motels get established that changes the nature of the environment rather than people coming changes.
I would say that it applies to both. I think that visitor accommodation in a residential environment has a whatever a larger impact on the residential feel of the location. And I think that residential VA would have an impact, but to a lesser degree. In terms of the second bullet point, which says reduced sense of safety for more strangers about not knowing neighbours, large number of empty units during off-peak times, leading to a sense of isolation.
But doesn't, don't the council's rules exacerbate that?
In terms of the use of holiday homes for residential VA?
You're going to have 323 days of the year where those houses are empty.
Yes, this does come through in the economic evidence I think it comes through in the evidence that residential VA can provide a financial incentive to have a holiday home as well.
But we have a lot of holiday homes in the district, don't we?
We do.
And Monica has even much more than Wednesday. Will the residential visitor accommodation provisions make a significant difference to those?
To the use of those holiday homes?
Well, to the use or the numbers? Will the proportion?
In terms of limiting residential VA, yes, it could have an impact on the viability of a holiday home. You would get less returns if you were letting out your holiday home for 42 nights versus 90 nights. So it may impact on a person's ability to own a holiday home. If they were servicing, for instance, they were servicing.
Given that they're not in this district, does this district plan need to be concerned about the economic viability of holiday homes?
No, I'm just using it by way of example in terms of the financial incentive that residential VA can provide for someone buying an investment property in the district, in our district.
Is there any evidence that happening to date. Given an anecdotal example, before we moved to Africa, we visited US Dean for 5 or 6 winters before that, staying in holiday homes in America. And that was in the period before the operative plan change. Now, we were not the only family doing that. And there's still lots of families doing that. I'm just wondering whether what has changed, what evidence you have that's changed or resulted from that activity that leads to these rules needing to be applied.
Certainly we know that the popularity of residential VA listings, there are more listings that are increasing on websites such as Airbnb, so we know that it's a growth industry.
Well, there's more listings, but are there more people coming? It's easy to list.
I'd like to check Mr. Hayes' evidence to see if that's accurate.
Yes. We'll go on a slight track because the evidence we had in stage one about the economics of the district was the importance of tourism and visitors to the district, to our economy. And the objectives and policies, the strategic direction and policies were designed to ensure that that value was not lost. Protecting the outstanding natural landscapes, for example, so that the flow of visitors was not turned off. The objectives and policies also aim to provide for people overall to work more from this, and such as the use of farms for tourist activities. Is the intention of the council with these rules to somehow try and turn the tap off?
No, that's not the intention. The intention in the key residential zones that are key providers of residential activities, key providers of housing, we're looking to safeguard that supply or provide better safeguards than are there in the operative rules.
Okay. So how many we'll take one because that doesn't have very much visitor accommodation. How many visitor bed nights was spent to Monaco last year? Do you know?
I don't know.
That information is available, isn't it? I'm sure I saw it in the paper.
Definitely the tourism would provide...
I don't have it to
hand. Yeah, that would be tourism would provide an uptake.
I would have expected that information to be in your evidence because by working out the number of visitor accommodation beds in Wanaka, multiplied by 365, you're probably saying 70% of and then you could work out how many visitors can't be accommodated by the visitor accommodation supply and whether that number has been increasing and where are they being accommodated. Because that is what we really have to be concerned with, not how many listings there are on Airbnb, but is there a flood of tourists pouring into our residential areas, or is there a, we know that in peak times there are, because you can't book anything, accommodation, less than 8 or 9 months or 12 months in advance. But I'm struggling to see how you can say you're protecting areas when you don't know what the issues are and how big an issue it is.
In terms of the provision of the number of beds to meet demand.
Well, it's not finding the figures that's important, it's actually analysing them and comparing them to what these rules are proposing to do. But the concern I have is that the opinions you've expressed to us on a lot of these things haven't been supported by evidence. And I'm a bit concerned that we can't make decisions without evidence. Just following on from my previous question, just over the page on page 38 in paragraph 6.30, the 6.2A report says there is no clear evidence that VA is having direct adverse effects on parking availability and noise built from a safety that can be distinguished from what would otherwise occur with permanent residential activities in these areas. The effects are more subtle in nature and relate to the neighbourhood feel and sense of safety from a combination of factors, such as high numbers of empty dark houses at night. Now, is that circumstance in 2018 in Wanaka, which you're more familiar with than any different from what it was in 2008? Suggested there was 35% unoccupied dwellings. And as I read the development testing report, summary this morning, there's some of the amount at present. So it hasn't really changed that proportion. So is that, given that, is there any difference in the last 10 years, given the unoccupied dwellings, which are high numbers of empty dark houses at night. Did this change?
The statistics tell us that this is the same portion of dwellings are unoccupied. There's been a lot of growth in their time, so if the proportion stays the same, the number would have increased with the growth that's occurred.
But will the effect become more or the same? If the proportion is the same, the number of other people has increased as well.
I agree that these effects are difficult to measure.
those effects come from empty dark houses at night. What is the council doing to deal with those effects?
Not the section 32 report.
Well, I know, but that's the issue that's been raised in the section 32 report.
Yes. No, we're not
in your rebuttal evidence, on page 21, you suggest that in the village, in the two village areas of Jack's Point, among the compliance for RDA and homestays, being changed to control.
So I've got different page numbers.
Sorry,
10.11.
Yes. What matters of control do you consider should be applied? You included that in your...
nature and scale of the activities. So it's at rule 41.5.2.6.
When you say controlling the scale of activities, what do you intend? Because you can't put a condition that limits the number, that nullifies the consent. So what is intended? And something like that is the compliance with the provisions. Wouldn't it be relevant matter of control to have some sort of control over the monitoring of the activities? Rather than saying you can't have more than 58 nights, isn't it more important to know how many nights they have?
In terms of monitoring the consent or monitoring the permitted activities.
And you can't put a monitoring condition on if it's not better to control things. The other question I had about that here is the evidence that we had in what the spring was, point of something like 18 hectares. And the amount of development on it is large and more likely to be akin to centre, the Queenstown town centre zone than anything else from the evidence we heard. Maybe not in height terms, but certainly on the intentions of the landowners and the expectations of a structural plan that they were talking to us about, and the pushback on the various controls on floor size of retail, etc. That turned out to be similar to the Queenstown Town Centre. Is that an area we'd be concerned about the residential visitor accommodation and the level of activity?
Yeah, I looked at it in the context of the Jacks Point provisions.
These are not helpful.
The provisions?
Ambitious.
That's not a reflection on the panel, I have.
Oh, no,
say.
That's okay. It took me quite a bit to actually get my head around the structural protector and Mr. Bergson's evidence, helpfully, because there were a lot of changes, obviously, from the 95 version, which was not relied upon for the first iteration of the VA provisions. The decisions version look quite different, as I've undertaken to renumber it in accordance with the decisions version of the chapter.
Yes.
But I put the Jacks Point provisions alongside the transition provisions, and my reading of them is that they aren't as enabling as a town centre. In terms of, a town centre
is not because of the decisions, but the expectation, and they've been appealed,
yes,
the expectation of this is somewhat different, but if the provisions that the council, the council's decision were upheld, that there needed to be a structure plan inserted into the plan for the village to develop, would that be an appropriate time to deal with the visitor accommodation in terms of scale and intensity and frequency of use?
Through the structure plan process?
Rather than putting a rule in that, or put a rule in that has to be dealt with in the structure plan.
That could be a different method to use. And that's a method that I hadn't considered.
The panel's recommendation, which the council upheld, was that the structure plan would need to come in by plan change. And that has been appealed ambitiously. That's Commissioner Nixon for it. Either the housing or business development assessment reports. Did you consider those in preparing that?
The capacity assessments?
The housing development assessment report and the business development assessment reports, the two that reports must have got as handed to us this morning electronically.
Yeah, so they're referred to in my section 42A in the section on the NPS. The housing one is.
So that's at paragraph 5.18.
5.18.
5.26 as we discuss it.
Yes, and yeah, within there are various points in that section up until 5.32 where it's discussed.
Okay. So just one question, maybe because my hearing needs testing, but in response to a question from the chair, did you say that the intention of is not to discourage RPO?
Not to stand out. It's to have a regime that it does limit it compared to the operative rules, but also to provide a regime where we can more effectively monitor it and enforce the rules. That's certainly been a challenge with the operative rules. And also to target it to the respective zones within the PDPs. That's certainly the refinements that I've tried to bring through compared to the notified version.
In terms of protecting the stock of rental accommodation, though, isn't it fair to say that it must have the effect of influencing decisions, influencing behaviour towards decisions such as sale of a rental property now? Essentially, it is trying to discourage me from switching from having a rental, using it as a rental property to using it as Airbnb, for example. Or if I'm contemplating buying a property in this district, it's disincentivizing me from making a choice to use it for RVA as opposed to buying it as a rental proposition. Because unless it has that effect, you're not going to succeed in protecting the rental housing stock. So it's saying, well, say I'm wanting to use it for RBA, I look at the rules and say, 42 days, well, that's not set on here. So this is really designed to alter decision-making behaviour, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yes, that disincentive isn't there currently. And yes, this is a method to try and protect our housing stock from non-residential. But it's also providing flexibility for it to occur within a more limited way than what's provided for in the option.
Well, I think I asked you a similar question, probably not as clearly as Commissioner Nixon. So while it's not the intention to stamp out RBA in the lower density or medium density residential zones, or say some of the rural lifestyle zones, it seems to me, and tell me if I'm correct, that it is the intention to limit or to encourage, limit RBA to be in association with permanent occupancy rather than being standalone long-term RVA in a property.
Yeah, I mean the homestay provisions are relatively enabling.
I'm not talking about homestay, but in terms of residential visitor accommodation.
Yes, in terms of the usual occupants being able to let their house out when they're not there.
Yes, so that's yes.
Yes.
So it's to push the scale of the activity to be such that it can be in association with permanent residential occupancy rather than anything greater than that, that then might drive out permanent occupancy.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So above my pay grade, but I'm enjoying the conversation, that's great.
So Ms. Bugay's evidence includes the rebuttal on the TIS request for the BA subzone, and of course she has adopted Ms. Stephen's evidence in chief on that submission. I have discussed with both of the witnesses, and if you have questions of Ms. Bugay's, she would prefer to have a rest and get work through Ms. Stephen's evidence first, and she can be recalled for any questions. raise the question that you would like answered in his reply evidence. He has come back to me overnight. So my notes, so this is the second matter, and my notes were along the lines of so seeking his input as an economist, so and taking into account the driver of the provisions being increasing affordability, a high growth rate, and an inability to provide long-term accommodation.
Long-term rentals.
The question I did write down was, is zoning, but I think it's meant to be other provisions, the BA provisions, the sole way of dealing with those issues?
Yes, the RMA provisions.
Yes, so he has asked, are you looking for him to respond on alternatives outside the RMA, or is it within the RMA that you were, the question is focused
on? What I'm trying to understand is, is the RMA the only solution, or are there other solutions which are outside the RMA and perhaps outside the possibility of the council's functions? Is the council trying to solve something through the RMA which actually needs a number of different things to solve? I'd like his view of the economic drivers and incentives overall.
Yes. Okay, no, that's helpful, thank you. And the reference to Tauranga, I believe, was that they have housing affordability issues, but they don't have the issue, or well, they don't have a high tourism rate in Tauranga.
But yes. Just an example of, yes, they have the same affordability and rental issues, as I understand it. But that's not driven by RBA, it's not driven by tourism, is not the big driver in town.
Yes. Okay, thank you. I can also, there was a separate question when I presented my legal submissions as to whether Remarkables Park has objected to the strikeout.
Yes.
My understanding is they haven't.
Right. I will ask Mr. Young when he appears.
Yes.
Rather than go through the formality of issuing a minute, asking for comments and then.
Absolutely.
Deal with the guidelines. That's more efficient.
Thank you.
I'll make a note of my timetable, so I don't forget to do that. If I may, because I did ask Mr. Hayes a question about you've done some work on the international examples, one in New York and one in Canada. And I did ask him if you could have a look at those reports and see how it turned out a year or 2 years ago. In terms of the effect of Airbnb is topping out, if there's any examples of getting to that stage.
Yes, I have that noted.
Sweet.
Yes, so this is two matters.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so turning to Ms. Devlin. Ms. Devlin has filed two statements of evidence. The first, section 42A, dated 23rd of July. Actually, she's filed three, my apologies. A supplementary statement of evidence dated 10th of August. And the first part of that evidence is on TEASE, so that has been taken over by Ms. Bobides, but the evidence still stands on the Glenn Dean and Sarah Burden submission. And then rebuttal evidence dated 22nd of August. She's also filed an evidence summary, so I'll ask her to read that to you. Do you have any questions? Do you have any corrections before you start?
No, not that I've found.
Okay.
There may be some typos in there.
It's more obligatory to find.
There's probably typos, but I haven't spotted anything that's worthy of typing.
But no, it's the correct ones.
Excellent.
Yes.
Thank you. Council's framework supports visitor accommodation subzones, VASZ, and residential zones, albeit in appropriate locations. The purpose of these, VAEZ, is to guide the location of commercial scale visitor accommodation activities in the underlying zones and to provide increased certainty regarding where visitor accommodation is an anticipated activity while addressing adverse effects on residential amenity, including character, traffic and noise effects. The provisions for VAEZ as notified have been largely retained, with specific amendments recommended by Ms. Valkeis. I do not support the use of VAEZs in rural zones, given the absence of a policy framework for them in the rural zones. And considering the hearing panel's earlier comments in this regard, and I refer there to the Stage 1 Hearing Panel Report 4B, and with reference to the PDP's strategic direction, which provides for the visitor industry within urban areas and settlements and locations where this is consistent with objectives and policies for the relevant zone. And I have noted, obviously, the earlier questions in that regard to Ms. Valkeis. I remain of the view that VA in rural zones should be consented under the fully discretionary rules, with associated provisions for residential visitor accommodation, RVA, and homestays. I recommend a VAEZ be applied over 8 additional submitter sites in Wanaka, Frankton, Fernhill, Sunshine Bay, and Arthur's Point. I consider that these VAEZs are appropriate in these specific locations for guiding the location of commercial scale VA activities in the underlying residential zones and providing increased certainty regarding where VA is an anticipated activity. In my view, these 8 additional VAEZs will implement the objectives and policies of the underlying zones, are the most appropriate way to achieve the strategic direction of the PDP, and are the most appropriate way to achieve the purpose of the RMA. For all other requests for a VAEZ, I consider that the notified PDP zones, without the addition of a VAEZ, and instead using the underlying zone, are more appropriate. I consider that these requests do not meet the relevant statutory tests and the rezoning principles set out in sections 3 and 4 of my section 42A report. The key outstanding matters of disagreement between myself and submitters who have filed evidence are A, whether a VASD is appropriate over 9 Southburg Ave, that's in Frankton, submitted 2616, Delos Investments Limited. B, whether a VASZ is appropriate over 9 Frankton Road, that's Greenwood Group Limited, that's near the Queenstown Gardens. C, whether a building restriction area is appropriate for the southern edge of the VASZ over Richards Park Lane at Fernhill. In this case, I have recommended a 4.5 metre building restriction area to apply to buildings for VA within the VASZ, to mitigate potential adverse effect on residential amenities, whereas the submitter considers that a VRA is unnecessary because there are already PDP provisions that more appropriately and effectively manage the issue of residential character.
We will adjourn until